So Angar Cyfundawd, the title is taken from one of the lines in the poem. It means hostile confederacy of opposing bards. We'll look at what that means in a minute. I think it's the longest poem in the Book of Taliesin. It's well over 200 lines, and it's got lots of different sections. But we're going to look at the very beginning of the poem here. It's quite likely that this poem was actually performed by a chap called Llywarch Ap Llywelyn, who was chief bard to the then King of Wales. So this isn't just any old poet. This is the highest ranking poet in Wales, performing in the persona of Taliesin and performing a poem that means this. The poet, here he is. I've already sung what he may sing. So the medieval audience have already cottoned on to the fact that Taliesin persona, is pointing to his dramatic context. He's in a bardic contest where apprentices and professional poets would come together and they'd have like a poetry standoff or a stomp, if you like, as we've seen in rap battles to this day. It's very macho, lots of machismo, probably loads of booze, lots of jostling, lots of shouting, lots of audience participation. And essentially, Taliesin has stood up and he said, the poet, there he is. There's the poet for you. But I've already sung what he may sing, suggesting I'm going to sing something that he can't sing. Let him sing only when the sage has drawn to a close, wherever he may be. Where the sage, where I, whenever I've finished, that's when he can sing, not before me. Don't forget your bardic manners, folks, okay? A generous one who refuses me, a patron, a generous one who funds the bardic tradition, essentially, a generous one who refuses me will never get anything to give. So anybody who denies my right to patronage will fail as a nobleman. You need me, the great Taliesin, to be a successful nobleman. There ain't no aristocracy without the bards. We make you famous, we dress you up in mythic clothes, we make you look shiny and special, even if you're the dumbest thug going, we can make you look good, and you need us for that. It's essentially the subtext here. We are also great and wise teachers and advisors. We educate you, we give you advice, we are lawyers on your behalf, we are advocates on your behalf, and we are ambassadors for you. These are the roles that the Welsh bards would fulfil at different times. So we're essential to you, the aristocracy. Through the language of Taliesin will come the prophet of manna, divine nourishment, essentially. Through my poetry, through my tradition, the great Taliesin, will come great prophet. When Cian died, Cian, of course, was mentioned in the earlier quotes from the Historia Brittonum, Cian Gwenith Gwawd, the wheat of song. When this great bard died, his retinue was numerous. He was such a great bard, he had enormous retinue. He was given many gifts by the patrons. So this is Taliesin just bigging himself up to begin with. I am the great Taliesin. I'm the best there is. The rest of you bards, you can sit down now. Let the master take over. And you, the patron, make sure that you pay me afterwards, because without me, you're nothing. Very bold, very clear statement of authority. No messing. So now that Taliesin's got that out of the way, we come on to the interesting part that I'd like you to interpret, please. Until death it shall be obscure, a Vagdir's declamation. Skillfully he brought forth speech in meter. So let's begin with these first two couplets here. Can anybody tell me who a Vagdir is?
Cerid Wen's son.
Thank you, Sam. Yes. Yeah, it's the other name, the folktale name given to Morvran, son of Tegid, or Morvran, son of Cerid Wen. So in the tale of Taliesin, Gwion Bach, the commonest boy around, is given the job of stirring the magic cauldron, and he accidentally gets the three drops of magical inspiration that were intended for Avagdi, whose other name is Morvran, just to confuse things. But there's something else going here now, because this is slightly different to the folktale that we have. Until death it shall be obscure, Avagthi's declamation. Skillfully he brought forth speech in metre. So what is different about this description of Avagthi from the one we have in the folktale? What's it suggesting?
That, well, that he's possessed of skill in this account,
mm-hmm.
whereas he's a sort of ugly, useless loaf in the other.
Mm-hmm. But in this account, he's a what, specifically?
Well, he's skilled in poetry, so in speech. Mm.
So he's a bard. What does it mean, until death it shall be obscure?
You only know it when you're dead. You'll only find out when you're no longer alive.
You'll only understand Avagthi's skillful declamation, in which he brought forth speech in metre, poetry, elegant bardic poetry. You'll only understand it when you're dead.
Is that another, as Sue says, another initiation reference? Bardic initiation?
Maybe.
Well, I was going to kind of echo that same thing, that, you know, only coming from other traditions that I do know about, that death doesn't always mean letting go of the body, but a death of a stage of life, a death of an idea, a death of, you know, things that we hold on to culturally. There's lots of kinds of death. And, you know, to be a perfected anything, in this case a bard, you know, you have to let go, you have to let a lot of you die to move on, to become something new, to be reborn. Death of the ego.
Well, you see, to be contrary, I don't think Taliesin's ego is dead. In fact, quite the opposite. But yes, if we're looking at it in terms of other spiritual traditions, then the death of the ego is something that could be of benefit. But here, I think that Taliesin is very much in full possession and making great use of the ego.
Can it also mean that death by entering an oven, so getting into that mystical state and into the other world?
If we interpret Arnoven as the land of the dead, which we can, although it's not explicit in the Welsh tradition that that's what it is, nowhere does it say, and the souls of the dead reside in Arnoven, but we can interpret it as meaning that, yes, absolutely. What lasts, or what persists through death, is skillful speech. So now we're talking about another character from the same story, but again in a different sense now. So a slightly different version of the Taliesin myth, or a different aspect of it. Gwion utters, so speech, and a deep one will come. Gwion utters, and a deep one will come. He, Gwion, would bring the dead to life, and yet he is poor. So this probably relates to the idea that Gwion is, in the folk story at least, the commonest boy around, and that although he comes from such a common or poor background, he still has this ability. Yeah, he still has this this ability to bring the dead to life, to achieve this bardic miracle. Gwion utters, and a deep one will come. What does that mean? Who is the deep one? Who is the deep one?
Is that not Taliesin? Is that not the profound bard will come out of the speech?
Absolutely, yes it is. Yes, thank you. So Taliesin as a deep one. Now just to draw your attention to the context that this poetry has been performed in once again. This is probably the highest ranking court bard in the land. Court bard, chief bard, advisor, friend, perhaps even teacher to the king, who is performing Taliesin. Gwion utters, and a deep one will come. So there's something about the notion of the bardic utterance that causes the evocation of Taliesin, which...
So is he there becoming... He's saying that the reciter is saying that he is as naive and as simple as Gwion himself, but when he speaks, then he becomes Taliesin. He's like, it's a sort of a false modesty or a bardic modesty.
Absolutely, yes. Thank you. Yeah. And yet he is poor. There is a modesty implied here associated with Gwion. And yet he has this miraculous ability to bring the dead to life, which is one symbolic way of describing the performance of an ancient chief bard. The performance or the evocation of an ancestral spirit in performance. This'll stump you. So you've all been too wise at answering these questions so far, but I'm sure this one will catch you out. They, referring to both Avagli and Gwion now, would make their cauldrons that were boiling without fire. They would work their materials for ever and ever. Passionately will song be brought forth by the deep, profound speaker. So that last couplet, we've already alluded to what that could mean, this deep, profound speaker. But what does it mean that Avagli and Gwion would make their cauldrons that were boiling without fire? Can anybody think why they are boiling without fire to begin with? What would cause them to boil without fire?
Breath of the maiden.
Yes, diolch yn fawr iawn. Thank you, Hilaire, yes. It's heated by the breath of nine maidens in the poem Pray the Anoven, which could be a medieval reference to the muses in the Hellenistic classical sense. So that's one reason why their cauldrons are boiling without fire, because these are bardic cauldrons and they are heated by the breath of maidens. Of course, the feminine figure often being associated as the possessor, the protector, the facilitator almost of the cauldron. We have Ceridwen as well. The three witches in Macbeth. They, Avagli and Gwion, would make their cauldrons that were boiling without fire. Okay, so these are magical cauldrons that are boiling magically. What does this have to do with what we're talking about in the poem at this point? Why is this relevant? Why they would work their materials forever and ever? So that I'm assuming that they are making cauldrons. That's what these two couplets are referring to. Avagli and Gwion making cauldrons, working at the materials. Smithcraft, yeah?
They're teaching. The cauldrons are the containers, the containers of the bardic tradition, who are the bards, their students, their lineage.
Thank you, Simon. Perhaps. I was hoping I could make you all suffer a bit more, but there you go. You've got there pretty quick. Yes, we can extend that understanding to interpret the cauldrons as being what? The cauldron is a symbol for what?
The memory of a people.
Yep, the memory of a people, which in an oral tradition would contain what? In a bardic tradition.
The stories.
And the...
poems.
Thank you. Diolch yn fawr iawn. Yeah, that'll do. And the triads and all of the lore associated with the bardic teaching. So yes, Avagli and Gwion would make their cauldrons. Notice that Avagli here is described as a poet. Gwion is described as a poet. So they're poets who are making symbolic cauldrons. We can also think of the three things that make a bard regular. The whole notion of a triad as also being symbolically represented by the three drops of wisdom, let's say, that comes out of the cauldron. Yeah. So it's a metaphor that we can extend to the actual texts themselves, this idea of the magic cauldron. So thank you. Yes, that's definitely one way of interpreting the symbolic imagery. Passionately will song be brought forth by the deep, profound speaker. So as we've said, this is essentially a description of Taliesin being the deep, profound speaker. In the Welsh original, Dofn there means deep. but is often translated in modern Welsh academia as simply meaning profound. But of course, Dofn relates to the whole notion of awen ddofn, of deep awen. Awen from annofn, the deep place, yeah? This is why I translate it as also meaning literally deep, as in from annofn. But it does also carry the connotation of profound. So passionately will song be brought forth by the deep and profound speaker. I think we can have both in there. This is the line that gives the poem its title. Hostile is the confederacy of opposing bards. So we're returning to the dramatic context now, where Taliesin is in dramatic opposition to the other bards in the court. And he goes on to have a go at them. Since such a great amount of the nation's poetry was on your tongues, why don't you declaim a declamation, a flow above the shining drink? Which is interesting because it mentions the oral tradition directly. Since you've got a wealth of traditional poetry, a great amount of the nation's poetry on your tongues, since you've all memorized this great body of ancestral literature, why aren't you the one who's declaiming a declamation, who's performing a poetry, a flow above the shining drink? This could be the ceinion, or ceremonial drink, that was given by the chief or the lord or the king of the court to those at the court at the beginning of proceedings, that was probably ceremonially blessed by the bard in this context. So why isn't it you guys who have the honour of conferring this blessing? Is essentially what he's saying there. When everybody's separated out, which basically means when we know what everybody's standard is, when we've sifted the good practitioners from the apprentices, from the poor bards, from the masters, when everyone's separated out, I will come with a song. Me, Taliesin. I'm a deep one who became flesh. Now, I have included I'm there. In the original, the I'm isn't included. It simply reads, I'll come with the song, a deep one who became flesh. So it could be, I'll come with a song about a deep one who became flesh. Again, Margaret Haycock thinks this is an allusion to Christ, but in my reading, considering what else has been said, passionately will song be brought forth by the deep, profound speaker. These speakers are Gwion and Avagdi and Cian and Taliesin, the language of Taliesin. These are bards who are the deep, profound speakers, okay? So that's why I disagree with Haycock's interpretation. I'm a deep one who became flesh. Literally saying, I am a spirit embodied in this performance, in my reading, yeah? I am a performer who is channeling this bardic ancestor. For 60 years, I endured solitude in the water gathered in a band around the earth and in the lands of the world. What's that referring to, those last two couplets there?
Where he's sent out to sea after... In the basket before coming back in.
Yep. Diolch yn fawr. Thank you very much. Yes. So, Ceridwen gives birth. She eats Gwion Bach because she hates him. And then she gives birth. And because it's still Gwion Bach, she knows it's the incarnated Gwion Bach. But now he's her child. She can't quite bring herself to kill him. So instead, she gives him to the river for him to work out his own fate. And he floats out to sea, and in one version of the story, yeah, he's out at sea for 60 years before he's reborn in the mortal realm on the beach at Barth or Conwy or wherever, whichever version you're reading. So that's just the beginning of this poem. It's very dense, there's a lot in there. It goes on for another couple of hundred lines. In my reading, at least, this is what an awenydd is doing. This is the position an awenydd takes up. When we look at what Giraldus Cambrensis is trying to describe. He may well have actually been describing lower-ranking awenyddion going into an ecstasy, going into an unconscious state and bringing forth inspiration in that way. That might be a real thing, particularly when we consider how ecstatic the performance of bardic poetry can be, to the staff beat, pulsing, driving rhythms, loud, exuberant declamation, sometimes performed in parties, you know, great energy of performance. But I think that what we have in Angad Cyfundawd is probably more in keeping with how the classical tradition considered the practice of the awenydd as a channeling of an ancestral awen, the channeling of an ancestral spirit, the evocation of an ancient cultural history and bringing that cultural history into the present moment, making it tangible and real and accessible to the audience, that was the service that's being provided. The sense of cultural history being served on a plate, essentially. Here you go, here it is, may it feed you. That's the service that the court bard is accomplishing here, I would say. And that, I would say, is the role of the awenydd, or at least I think it was back in history. We're really looking at a very Welsh conception of what awen is, because of course this whole process is mediated through awen. Yeah, this doesn't happen without awen. The ancestral awen, as in something coming through from the past into the present moment, but also the energy of performance, what happens in the moment of performance, and awen as a tangible feeling and dynamic and connection between performer and audience. That is also awen, and that requires a mastery. So you, all of those things that the triads mentioned are required for the expression of that awen. The audience have to believe in your authority. The audience have to believe in your skill and your craft. They have to have witnessed that skill and that craft and experienced it before they can buy into the whole notion of you evoking this ancestral spirit. Yeah, it's a complete cultural package, if you like, is how archaeologists would put it. You can't separate out the awen from the craft, from the ancestral spirit, from the performance. They're all in there together. They're all working towards the same end. Yeah, the bards were the gatekeepers to that experience. That was why they were worthy of being paid. They provided the mythic architecture of the court, if you like.